Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Sylvie Rivera, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. It is my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you will enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. Now, here are some of our upcoming Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum events. On May 19th, we have Mr. Jay Su, Director of the Asian Art Museum, speaking about understanding Shanghai's art and material culture. And on June 15th, Bonnie Tsui, a journalist at the New York Times, we'll talk about Chinatown, a people's history. And these are just two of many upcoming programs, and I invite you to sign up for our email list if you'd like to receive updates on our programs. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones are turned off. And now, after a second introduction, I'll begin today's program. Enjoy that. Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Sylvie Rivera, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. John Leaders, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, licensed acupuncturist, certified in gynecology and internal medicine at Zhejiang Chinese Medical University, certified in integrated diabetes prevention and treatment at the Tsinghua Hospital in China, and also a professional member of the American Diabetes Association. On November 9th last year, Dr. John Needers was speaking in this same room on traditional Chinese medicine and its relevance today. The hour-long program was, of course, not enough to encompass such a vast subject and to answer all the questions from the audience. So Dr. Needers ended up staying around for a while after the program. This is why the Commonwealth Club of California has invited him again for part two of our series with another vast topic, food as medicine. And I wish to thank him for taking the time in his busy schedule to be here again tonight. One of traditional Chinese medicine principle is to preserve health, even before curing. And nutrition has a major role in this preservation. But today, in our post-industrial societies, with their epidemics of catastrophic proportions of diabetes, obesity, cancer, and etc., it seems like food in many instances has become a poison and not a remedy anymore. As a teacher of both Asian dietetics and Western nutrition, Dr. John Needers will guide us through the integration of these systems to attain optimal health and balance. So now, without further ado, please welcome Dr. John Needers.
Thank you, and thank you for the really kind introduction. It was so fun the last time I was here. We stayed for about two and a half hours, I think. They finally threw us out. And I promised them, again, Sylvie was very kind in saying that we didn't get through everything. I got through about a third of my presentation. So I've cut this one by two-thirds, and we may get through it. But what I invite you to do is, again, these are two vast subjects. When I teach these subjects in school, you know, they're hundreds of hours per class for Western nutrition, for Chinese nutrition. So in 40 minutes, we're going to just hit the very, very pinnacle. So what I invite you to do is to really start thinking of some questions that you'd like to ask at the end so we can kind of fill out some some things, because I'm determined to get through this on time today. It'll be a first. So again, what we're looking at is traditional Chinese medicine, food as medicine. Now, that title doesn't seem like much, but it's incredibly significant. In the West, in the medical field, you will not find more than 1% of medical doctors who think of food as medicine. In China, every doctor thinks of food as medicine, not as separate, not as something that you do separately, but as the cornerstone and the foundation of health and healing. And again, I deal with patients all day who are coming from their Western physicians and are getting great advice about many things, but the thing they don't get good advice about is nutrition. So let's talk about that a little bit. The agenda, we're going to do a very short history of TCM, or traditional Chinese medicine, talk just a touch about some of the basic differences in the systems, and then look at some really fundamental, simple things about traditional Chinese medicine and how we look at eating. And it's actually very different than what most people believe from looking at Western nutrition. One of the things we look at a lot is the temperature quality of foods and the very fundamental nature of food, as opposed to just the vitamin or mineral content. In fact, that's very far down the line for us. It's important, but not as important. And then at the end, I would like to talk about the most important foods and nutrients to have in your diet, in my opinion, and also the things that are most important to avoid. Now, the odds are I won't get to that. So that's a great thing to start thinking about when you start asking questions. You know, if you want to get my top five, either way, that would be good. Yeah. So, again, a brief outline of Chinese medicines, a medicine. It is the oldest continuously practiced system of medicine in the world. And when I say professional, there is folk medicine in China, just as there's folk medicine in the United States and in Mexico and Costa Rica. Everybody has a folk medicine. And many of those folk medicines are very valuable. But what I'm talking about here is professional medicine. The professional medical schools in China are almost 2,000 years old. It was very difficult to get into medical school, at least as difficult as it is to get into medical school here today. So it was a very professional, clear curriculum. And the exams were really tough. I mean, there are many stories of people, you know, well, I won't go into all the horrible stories right now. We'll talk about it later. The Huang Di Nei Jing, the Yellow Emperor's classic of medicine, this is really the seminal work on Chinese medicine. So if you ever want to pick up a book and just have some fun, there's some very good translations now. This book is attributed to the Yellow Emperor. The Yellow Emperor is the emperor that united all of China for the first time. He's the one who set up the system of canals. He's the one who enforced a consistent writing system throughout all of China. And that's one of the reasons Chinese medicine is so powerful, is that it has a 2,500-year unbroken series from doctor to patient, from grandfather to father to child to son, in terms of the lineage. So it's been unbroken with the same language. And unfortunately, there are many wonderful medical systems that have come into being throughout the world that we don't know much about because they got destroyed. For example, in China, 2,000 years ago, there was a fellow named Huato, and Huato was actually doing open body cavity surgeries 2,000 years ago. So he was cutting people open, taking their liver out, doing surgeries, massaging the liver, taking other organs out. Now, that was 2,000 years ago. So you figure he had to have very powerful anesthesia, very powerful antiseptic, and a phenomenal knowledge of anatomy. And he did this quite regularly. Now, that was well before those things were done in the West. And again, a lot of that's because of that unbroken circle. Now, the Huang Di Nei Jing estimates range from 2,200 to 4,500 years. It was probably written about 2,500 years ago. And if you read it and know anything about Chinese medicine, and if you read it, you'll discover a lot about Chinese medicine, you'll probably be astounded at the accuracy. 2,500 years ago, they were talking about specific acupuncture points to use for almost any condition you can think of, and particular herbal formulas. And if you actually go look at current biomedical research, scientific research on those herbs, you'll find that they very accurately treat the conditions that they were prescribed for 2,500 years ago. How they knew that? Interesting. By the way, nobody knows how old acupuncture is. You know, when my wife and my son and I were back at the Smithsonian, we looked at the exhibit for the Iceman. Does anybody remember the Iceman? He was a guy that was found in the Swiss Alps, and I believe he's about 8,000 years old, around there. And one day, and they take him out periodically to check him out, and then they put him back in the freezer, and they have different groups of experts come to look him over. And one day, there was someone there that said, you know what? Those are acupuncture points. And the lines, the tattoos, those are acupuncture meridians. And so they brought in a professor of acupuncture, and he said, yeah, absolutely. Those tattoos are outlining the channels, the energy meridians, and the points are on the points. And not only that, these are the conditions that you should expect to find. And indeed, when they did MRIs, et cetera, they did find the very conditions. So that's 8,000 years ago. There's a statue of the Malta woman, which is an earthen statue embedded with precious stones. And she's clearly in the process of delivering a baby in this statue. And the points that are illuminated with these precious stones are exactly the points that we would use today to assist a woman through that type of delivery. She's 14,000 years old. So nobody knows how old this is, this method of healing. And by the way, I talk about traditional Chinese medicine, and it's important to realize that India, Japan, a lot of the Southeast Asian countries, there was a constant flow of information. There's actually a good deal of information from Persia that ended up in Chinese medicine. They would take whatever worked from anywhere. So I talk about traditional Chinese medicine, but it's really this global medicine that was practiced. There are essentially five branches of traditional Chinese medicine. I actually teach at Five Branches University, which is named for that. The one we know most about in our culture is acupuncture. Also with that is moxibustion, which is a method of heating acupuncture points, which we talked about last time. Herbal medicine, which we know, you know, people are starting to become pretty savvy about. There are a lot of studies now being done. By the way, there are 10,000 well-done scientific studies per year that come out of China alone on the validity of herbal medicine. There are clinics, there are formulas that will have 1,000 to 1,200 biochemists working on the formulas as they're testing them in a series of hospitals. Now, these are formulas that are thousands of years old, and they are still looking at the biochemistry of it. So people walking around with 24-hour blood glucose monitoring, pulse oximeters, to check exactly. They know the formulas work. Now that what they're doing is validating and determining exactly why and how they work. Tuina massage and medical qigong are another area. Nutrition, which we're going to talk about tonight, and then exercise and energetic work. Now, the thing that's interesting, one of the key differences from Oriental medicine to Western biomedicine is the hierarchy. If you go to a hospital in the United States, the big dog is the surgeon, right? On the bottom end of the totem pole is the clinical nutritionist. And in between, there are the people that are doing the drugs, right? But that's kind of the hierarchy. Not, I don't mean doing them, I mean giving them, but or whatever. This is, and by the way, all of these have tremendous amounts of scientific validity. I probably have 5,000 studies on here looking at the validity of these systems. This is kind of a fun, I'm going to move away from the mic a minute. This is the...
Almost 50% in the last 6 years. It's now now up into the 40,000 to 50,000 range just from painkillers per year. So we consider that a relatively low form of medicine. Doesn't mean we wouldn't, that I send patients out to get painkillers. I'm not against them. We just feel it's the most crude form of medicine. Above that, we have invasive passive equipment medicine. That would be surgery. That's one step up here. Now, I'm not against surgery either. I've had people in my family whose lives were saved from surgery. I've had surgery. However, we consider it a last ditch. And believe me, I have a lot of patients come into my clinic who are told they have to have surgery and don't. I actually got two patients in one day. This was a fun day. Who were told they had to have their bowels removed, their large intestine. One had colitis. The other one had such severe constipation, their doctor said, we need to take out your intestine. Fortunately, they didn't, and now they're both fine. The colitis, his colitis is, he's down to 3 milligrams of prednisone, but he'll be off of that in another month. His doc said he doesn't have to have the surgery. He's 6 months past. And the other woman has a bowel movement every day, and she loves me. Right? I can hear those little shouts. Yay! And above that, but notice down here, third, is acupuncture. Acupuncture in Chinese medicine is considered the most crude form of medicine that we do. That's because we are inducing something in you. We are moving your energy. We're using the needles. It's still a much higher form to us of medicine than the others, but still we're doing it to you. And then above that, we get into energy body work, herb supplements. And again, herb supplements, vitamins, and minerals, these to us are simply an extension of nutrition. These are not something separate from nutrition. Herbs and food to us are the same thing. Herbs are called the forgotten food. They just taste bad, right? If they tasted good, we call them a food. But people don't want to eat them, so we call them an herb. But essentially, that's what we're looking at. And then as we get into, from here up, we're looking at things that you do to yourself, that you do with yourself. And that's always my goal in my practice, is to educate, is to have you take over your healing. And that's the principle of Chinese medicine, which is why in China they can have a system that actually is better for a larger group of people at 5% the cost of the U.S. medical system. It's because of this education. When you go to a diabetes clinic over there, it has nothing that you would resemble to a diabetes clinic here. The level of cohort that is developed over there, the level of training is so radically different you wouldn't even begin to recognize it. So again, as we go higher on this, we're looking at things that bring you closer and closer to perfect balance. And that's what the yin-yang is. It's perfect balance. These are things that won't bring you into balance. They'll just let you live long enough that hopefully you can get into balance.
Looking at Chinese medicine versus biomedicine, and I don't mean versus like they're anti. I mean, let's look at some differences here. The propaganda, and I say propaganda quite literally, this is someone propagating an idea, is that biomedicine is based on science and TCM isn't. Actually, this is the more I look into it, I think it may be the reverse. The only 20 to 30% of all medicine as practice is based on science. Now, that argument's been around a long time. Archie Cochrane, who was the god of random controlled trials, he invented it, said that not more than 20% of medicine as practiced is based upon on science. Many people objected to his things, argued with him. I've read the study, the arguments. They don't hold water. In fact, the very people that were arguing that it was more than 20 actually proved that it was less than 20. So that doesn't make it wrong, you understand. It just makes it the statement that it's based on science untrue. Every time a drug is used off-label, that is not science. Because the science is for a particular usage. Although the science is often flawed, at least that's the point. But every time it's used for something else, that is not science. Every time a surgery is done that hasn't been randomly controlled in trials, that's not science. So that's what we're looking at. And there's massive scientific data for TCM. Again, at least 10,000 studies on herbs alone and nutrition. So look at the scientific method. It's usually misunderstood. Science is nothing more and nothing less than a method of exploring reality. It's not the truth, nor will it lead to the truth. It's just a really powerful method of examining reality. That's what it is. In biomedical nutrition, the evidence is actually quite sporadic. So what we get is a lot of fad medicine. How many of you have watched nutritional shows on television over the last 20 years? Well, the current fad changes every 6 months. Do you eat chocolate? Do you not eat chocolate? Are fats good for you or fats bad for you? Is butter good for you? Right? Are eggs good for you or eggs bad for you? And it changes every few weeks depending on some partial study that is often misinterpreted. So it's very fad-based, even the best of it. And I read lots and lots and lots of Western science on nutrition, and I appreciate the science, and I see the shortcomings. Yeah, there are too many gaps that people forget about. And so there's some good science, some bad science, and a great deal of misinterpretation. According to the Cochrane Collaborative, 38% of studies in general in science that they look at, the conclusion of the author does not match the results of the study that they themselves did. So that's what we're looking at. So when you read something in the Chronicle, it is 7 times removed from this study that only has a 62% chance of being accurate as reported. Believe me, whatever you read in the Chronicle, you cannot trust at all. And if it's on the news, even less so. Okay? And I can poke holes in almost all of the studies that you see about on TV. So there's a lot of misinterpretation, usually because the people involved don't read the study. This is particularly true in nutrition. The Framingham Heart Study was the groundbreaking study that took huge groups of people and analyzed risk over a period of decades. In that study, there was shown to be a correlation, not causation, but a correlation of heart attack and stroke from cholesterol, from high cholesterol. That study showed that only men aged 35 to 55 were actually at risk in the first study. Now, there have been some changes, but that was the first study. And no correlation for women, except some diabetics. In a very recent edition of Medscape, the journal for doctors, nurses, etc., it showed that women on statin drugs have a 10% higher overall mortality rate. Higher, not lower. Now, if you take out diabetic women, because a few diabetic women do get benefit, then the overall mortality rate is 14% higher. And the reason for that is the misinterpretation of the data, which was meant for men and extrapolated to women. But you see this all through nutritional studies. I remember when the Framingham Heart Study came out, it says, don't eat eggs, don't eat butter, don't eat any of these foods. And that was the opposite of what it said in the original study. It did not say don't eat eggs. It did not say don't eat butter. It said, in fact, if you want to lower cholesterol levels, eat fat. If you want to raise cholesterol levels, eat carbohydrates. The original study. But what got to the front lines and what medical doctors are still telling their patients, because I see the sheets that come in, don't eat eggs. Don't eat butter. The reality, if you eat eggs for breakfast, exactly the same caloric value per day, and exactly the same caloric value at that meal, which is breakfast. If you eat eggs versus someone that eats bagels, again, same caloric value, you will lose 56% more weight if you eat the eggs, right? But don't eat those eggs. They're deadly. Butter prevents heart attacks. That was conclusively proven in the 30s and 40s by Weston Price. He did 10,000 studies on butter fat, proving that the more butter, healthy butter, grass-fed, right, high-quality butter, the lower the heart attack rate, and he checked it throughout the world and throughout many communities in the United States. In fact, the last estimate I saw is that margarine probably killed 500,000 people when we went on the margarine kick. There was no evidence whatsoever. It was a fad. So, study in Europe. Well over 12,000 people. I couldn't remember the number, but I know it was over 12. Ate 14 eggs a week. There was zero increase in their cholesterol levels. Zero. So, scientific method, you observe apparent reality, you create a hypothesis, you take that out in the world and test it, you arrive at a theory, and then you test it, and test it, and test it some more. That is the scientific method. There's nothing holy about it. Now, the more accurately you test it, the more you can randomize it and control it, the more accurate it is. But there's nothing sacred about it. Now, in fact, this is what happens with that research. How many of you have heard of Colin Campbell? He wrote the China study. Okay. Colin Campbell was on the committee. He's one of the top nutritionists in the world. He's on the committee that created the Western food pyramid. I talked to him about it. He said he went kicking and screaming when they insisted that this get published because he knew it was total BS. There is nothing, well, that's not true. There are a few things. In general, this is the worst food pyramid they could have settled on. They did it because they thought the American, this is the stated opinion, the average American can't tell the difference between good fat and bad fat, so we'll tell them not to eat fat. That was what they came up with, is that we were too stupid to understand this. And so what they did is they told people to eat 6 to 11 servings of grain. You will be a diabetic. If you eat a grain-based diet, eating 11 servings of carbohydrate a day, unless you're getting massive amounts of exercise and significant amounts of fat to balance that, you're very likely to become diabetic. And this food pyramid, if you'll notice, isn't working, right? One-third of the people alive in the year 2000, according to the CDC, will have diabetes at some point in their life. In China, who have adopted our food pyramid, you can find McDonald's everywhere, they now have 90 million diabetics, 90 million, because they've moved from their traditional way of eating to our way of eating, 90 million. Chinese nutrition. So the Taoists were great observers of reality. They created many hypotheses. They tested those. They observed the results. They were phenomenal observers of reality. Came up with new theories, and they nailed it. 2,500 years ago, they nailed nutrition in a way that Western medicine still has not come to yet. Now, using the brilliant advances in Western science, there are a lot of things about Chinese nutrition that we now understand why they work, but it really doesn't matter. It always did work, it does work, and it will work. And it's actually far more workable. So, in Chinese medicine, we hear a lot about the five-phase theory, which is often called five elements, which is a misnomer. But the five-phase theory can explain many, many, many different things in reality: food, governments, countries, individual life flow. And the point in Chinese medicine that is every person is different. That's one of the things that makes us different. I was doing a class once on herb-drug interactions, and I was saying, you know, because I have to, does that come loose? Okay, we'll do that. I just hate being stuck back there. And I was talking about, in this particular case, ginseng, which is a very popular herb. And I was pointing out that ginseng can increase blood pressure. And there was a Korean man in the class, and he got incensed. He says, "No, we use ginseng all the time to lower blood pressure. We use it all the time to lower blood pressure." I said, "Yeah, that's fine. And it can raise blood pressure." And he got really incensed again. He's a student. He's very zealous. And so I said, "Okay." And I looked at three people in the class, and I had them come up and stand in front of them. I said, "Now, which of these three people is it likely to raise their blood pressure?" Everybody in this Chinese medicine class pointed at the same person. And that's the difference. Western medicine relies on statistics, which are very valid, and for large-scale epidemiological studies, it's great. You need that. But Chinese medicine recognizes that everybody here is a completely different individual. You have different body temperatures. You have different hormone levels. Everything about you is different. And we can't utilize the same body of knowledge clinically that we do theoretically. So if we have three patients, we would give ginseng to the two that we know it won't raise their blood pressure, and we wouldn't give it to the third, right? So it's not a random controlled trial, but it works. And so every circumstance is different, the seasons, everything, the temperature. So there's no perfect diet. Anybody that sells you a diet book and tells you it's the perfect diet, run away. What you need to eat, what she needs to eat, is not what I need to eat. I promise you. Okay? What I need to eat in fall is not what I need to eat in summer. So in Chinese medicine, we look at Jing. Jing is the magic. This is your vital life force, the most fundamental essence of you. So we're putting Jing in. Hopefully, we got some from our parents, from our food. We inherited a little bit. And then we're going to spend some stress, childbirth, maybe drug abuse, whatever, working too much. And so what we're always looking for is to balance that Jing. Everything in Chinese medicine is looking at, this is the Jingometer, right? And so we put you in, you come in the clinic, we attach you to our Jingomatic. I am kidding. We don't really. So essentially what we're trying to do is to look at you as an individual and say, what will balance this human being? What will create balance? And this is the cycle that we look at. It's called the generating cycle. And again, this is what I'm talking about. Everything in our reality goes through this on some level. So if you were starting a new business, that would be wood. You'd be growing. It would be new. It would be fresh. There's a lot of energy. It's budding forth. And then the wood would support fire. And the fire is when you're burning. Your business is starting to take off, and you're feeling really good about it, and everybody's really moving forward. And then you might get into the earth phase, where things kind of level off. And again, any of you in finance know this is a curve for a business. That's what happens. And then it will start, the dividends start to go down about here, and everybody kind of levels off. And then you go into the metal phase, is when things are starting to slow down, and then into retirement. That's this phase. And so wood is associated with spring, with growth, with new things, and the liver. Fire is associated with the heart and summer. The earth is associated with what we would call long summer or Indian summer, the time when we're harvesting. And it's more neutral. Metal is associated with the lungs. It is the fall, the time of year when the lungs get most affected by the weather. And water is the element of the kidney, and that's the winter. So we see this continuous movement around in Chinese medicine. So one of the things we want to analyze is, where are you on this, and what do we need to bring you into balance? Now, we don't always talk about it with you, but we're always noticing that. The color of your skin, your complexion, where you have different discolorations will all tell us about this. The tone of your voice. As soon as someone walks into the office, you're going, ooh, boy, liver depression, cheese stagnation, very wood, right? And you see that, and you know what you're going to deal with as a patient. They're going to be very intense. A couple of other cycles that I'm not going into, but we look at, this is the controlling cycle, and again, I'm not going to take much time, where wood controls the earth. And again, if you're interested, there's lots of great information on this. This is the over-control, and this is what we see a lot, where wood assails earth, where the liver overacts on the spleen. Probably 80% of my patients fit into this, where they are so stressed, where they are so... In Chinese medicine, we talk about the what damages the liver is unfulfilled desires. Okay? Now, most of my patients have massive unfulfilled desires. I see kids who are 3 years old who are in competition to get into the best preschool, who will then be in competition to get into the best grammar school, who will be in competition to get into the best high school, who will be in competition to get into the best college, who will be in competition to get into the best graduate program, and then will be in competition for the rest of their life. That is really abnormal. And that causes massive, massive liver depression, cheese stagnation affecting the liver, which assails earth, which causes dampness in the earth. So the number one cause of obesity is stress. If you can't lose weight, I guarantee you're stressed. That's the number one thing. When we deal with obesity, when we deal with that, we have to get people to de-stress because their hormones are so out of balance, their cortisol, insulin, and leptin cycles, that they develop insulin resistance, and they could eat a 200-calorie-a-day diet and exercise 4 hours a day, and they cannot lose that weight. So we have, in Chinese medicine, we rebalance the wood and earth. From a Western standpoint, we get rid of their insulin resistance. Same thing. A couple others. But anyway, back to the generating cycle. Now, this is one. This is seasonal. And everything we give as dietary prescriptions will be based on this cycle, because what you eat in the spring determines your health in the summer. What you eat in the summer determines your health during long summer. What you eat here determines your health here. For example, wood, spring is the time of detoxification. You were supposed to eat really heavy foods during the winter. You're supposed to gain weight during the winter. That's what animals do. But in the spring, if you watch, every animal is out eating grass. They're eating green things. They are purging. They are detoxifying. If you don't do the detoxification here, when you get to summer, this massive heat will overpower you, and that's heart attack city. That's why it's so critical to detox in the spring before you get to the summer. But another element of timing is the daily clock. In Chinese medicine, every organ system, every meridian system has a time of day when we feel, in fact, when it is actually, most active. And if you live your life according to that timing on a daily level and that timing according to an annual level, you'll be in better health. So in Chinese nutrition, we say the time of year is critical. The time of day is critical. Eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a merchant, and dinner like a pauper. Eat at regular times and eat only when you're calm. And I'm going to just go show a couple meridians here because I want to point this out. In here on the stomach meridian, the active time of the stomach meridian is 7 to 9 a.m. By the way, I didn't put the large intestine. The active time of the large intestine is 5 to 7 a.m. That woman that they were going to cut out her intestine, I made her get up, or I didn't make her, but I asked her to get up and do a ritual to prepare herself to have a bowel movement before 7 o'clock. Because if you can do it before 7, it is much, much easier because that's when the large intestine is the most active. So that she did, and she's fine. The stomach is most active to 7, 9 a.m. That's when it's the strongest during the day. So that's when you want to put food into it. If you're going to eat a big meal, that's the time the stomach can best deal with it. The time of the spleen, and the spleen is responsible for energy development and assimilation, that's from 9 to 11 a.m. That's when your food should be getting assimilated, and you should have your highest activity part of the day is from 9 to 11. Now, if you look at Paleolithic cultures, the estimate is that they work 2 to 3 hours a day. You know, we have all these labor-saving devices, so we work 14. They work 2 to 3 hours per day. In the Bay Area, the estimate is 1 hour a day. And if you look at every indigenous culture, they are always up at sunrise, have a bowel movement, eat, go out and work, and they're through about noon. And if you look at normal circadian rhythms for human cortisol, it exactly matches that pattern. You have the highest cortisol levels about 7, 8 a.m. They drop to about noon, and then they continue to drop toward evening. And if you try to go against those normal cycles, you will gain weight. Because if you have to kick in and go exercise in the evening, do more work in the evening, you have to release more cortisol from your adrenal glands so that you can function. That causes your insulin mechanisms to be thrown off, your leptin systems to be thrown off, and you will gain weight. So if you can front load your day, it's a much easier way and a better way to eat. I threw this in here because these two, just for the heck of it, the gallbladder is most active from 11 at night to 1 p.m. And if you ask any surgeon, they'll tell you that's when they get their patients come in with their gallbladder attacks, is usually around midnight. And so for that reason, you should have no food on board, particularly greasy, spicy food at that time. If you're going to eat that food, you should eat it earlier in the day and make sure it's out of your system by the time of the gallbladder. The time of the liver is 1 to 3. Now, most people in our culture, we're all carrying several hundred chemicals that didn't even exist 100 years ago, and they are being handled primarily by your liver. They're being detoxified by your liver. Your liver has a massive amount of work to do. And if you are still digesting food and the liver's still breaking down those products, it can't do its proper job from 1 and 3 in the morning. And that's when blood tends to pool in the liver. And that's when cleansing should happen. So you must stop eating by 7 so that you have 5 hours of digestion before 1 o'clock to keep the liver healthy. Now, you know, you can get away with anything when you're 20, and if you do enough other things right, you can get away with eating at midnight, but over time, it will wear out your system. So just as one example, I took long summer, time of change. So this is moving from extreme yang, the heat of the summer is yang, to yin. We're moving to the fall. And it's time to change the approach to life, to adjust to the cold weather. And so, again, we want people to start changing their lifestyle about this time because of the climatic changes, and also to make sure that if they have a spiritual practice or a contemplative practice, this is the time that it's very critical to do that at that transition. Now, in terms of food, it's the time, and I just took one season. We could do this for every season. Long summer is the time to get rid of cold foods, move to neutral foods. By cold, I mean things like watermelon, ice drinks. If you eat ice, which you shouldn't, you certainly shouldn't at this time of year, because you need to start warming your body. You need to start preparing for the coolness of fall. The colors of the earth are yellow, orange, red, all the foods that are available, because we were designed as human beings to eat seasonally, because we didn't have a choice. Right? In the spring, you ate what was available in the spring. In summer, you ate what was available in summer, etc. Now, because of our modern refrigeration and canning, we can get away with that, and it's destroying our health. The more you eat seasonally, the healthier you'll be. So, in the earth, you want fruits and vegetables that are seasonally available. From a Western standpoint, these are foods that are very, very high in antioxidants, the red, yellow, orange foods, very high, beta-carotenoids. So what those are doing in the long summer, they're preparing your body for the stress of the fall, for the influenza, for any other viral illness that's coming along. These antioxidants are preparing you, and those foods are very high antioxidant foods. By season, in spring, you want green foods, vegetables. You want a detox. In summer, you want foods that are, because it's hot, you want cooling and moist. Watermelon is the ideal summer food. You want external spices, things that make you sweat, hot chili peppers. You don't want things like cinnamon that bring the heat internally. You want things that make you sweat, because that will cool you off. Long summer's the harvest. Again, you want red, yellow, orange foods, because this is the transition to warmer foods. In the fall, you want the energy moving to the interior, so you're starting to eat heartier soups, rice, potato, mushroom. Again, the color of the fall is white. Rice, potato, mushrooms, radishes, etc. Those foods that are primarily and overwhelmingly protective for the lungs. Very powerfully protective. Then in the winter, you need the heat to go internally. So you need deep warming energy, a lot of internal spices, meat, fat, stews, heavy foods. This is the time of year to eat heavy foods if you're going to eat heavy foods. Now, went sideways. This is just for an example. So for an example, if you're a tea drinker, in the spring you want green teas. Right? They're very invigorating. They're very detoxifying. They have extremely high epigallocatechin and gallate and other flavonoid levels that really clean out your system. In the summer, it's so hot, you might want to switch to white teas, which are very, very light and delicate, and or a fragrant light green tea like a jasmine. In long summer, again, we're starting to go to warmer, so you want to do maybe oolongs or pu'er teas, maybe heavy green teas if it's moderate temperature. In fall, you need to go to heavier black teas to keep the heat internally. And in winter, it's not an accident that Earl Grey is such a popular tea in England. The bergamot or the variety of other spices you can use are internally heating spices. So by mixing that with the black tea, it brings the heat to your center and warms you on a very deep level rather than superficially. So again, that's an example. Now, this example, every single category of food is and can be broken down like this, and we do. If I have a patient that comes in that's overheated, if they eat meat, I will pick a cooling meat like pork. If they're very cold, if they're deficient, particularly a woman that gets cold with menstruation, I'm going to give her lamb, maybe even venison, because they're very, very heating. So every single food and every category of food in Chinese medicine is broken down this way, as is every single herb. They are all broken down by whether they create heat, whether they are cooling, whether they go internal, whether they're external, and whether exactly which energy channels and organs of your body they affect. So that's every single food and every herb, and they are looked at as the same entity, basically. And I'm almost done. 1 minute. Okay. because I want to get through it once. The bottom line, though, is you cannot, no matter how well you eat, you cannot get the food that people got 100 years ago. Because the cord blood, you know, on a brand new baby has nearly 200 chemicals that didn't exist 100 years ago. Okay? When they do aspirations on breast fluids from women, the level of carcinogens has gone up over 100 times in the last 20 years. So you can't get the food, but you need to do the best you can. You've got to go out and find the best quality foods that you can. If you can grow it yourself, it's better. Eat seasonally. And we won't go through that. We'll talk about that later. Okay, I'm done. Thanks.
Well, our thanks to Dr. John Leaders, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, for his comments here today. And we will now continue with our question and answer session. I would just like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to part two of our traditional Chinese medicine series, Food as Medicine, with Dr. John Leaders.
You mentioned, you know, right at the beginning, a good question would be, what's the five best foods that you can eat in the Chinese semester? And I want to eat them all year round and want to know why I should eat them and the benefits I get from eating these five foods.
Okay. Well, we got about another 2 hours here. Good. Yeah. Number one, and again, many of the things I'm going to talk about now have become more broadly known over the last few years. People have become a lot more savvy about nutrition, fortunately. The thing that is most missing, the two things most missing from our diets, again, I think most of you know this, one is fiber, high-quality fiber. In China, the average fiber intake today per day is 33 to 35 grams. In the U.S., the average is 10 to 11 grams. In China, the average number of bowel movements is 3 per day. In the U.S., the average number of bowel movements is 1 every 3 days. We have 10 times the colon cancer. Do the math, right? So fiber. The best defense against diabetes, other than stress reduction, is fiber. If you eat fiber 30 minutes before you have a meal, it radically alters how you not only the uptake of carbohydrates and simple sugars, but also how the body handles it. And so most of you are familiar with the glycemic index. If you take a relatively high to moderate glycemic food, if you take enough fiber with it, you can turn it into a relatively low glycemic food. So fiber would be number one. And again, in my clinic, we shoot for 3 bowel movements a day. We settle for 2, but we want 3. The other one, of course, we are looking at such a dramatic shift in how animals are raised and fish. You know, we'd have farmed fish, et cetera, which is really atrocious. But we're looking, you know, the estimate is that Paleolithic people got an omega-3 to an omega-6 ratio of about 1 to 1, maybe 2 to 1 in some areas of omega-6s to 3s. Omega-3s are the most anti-inflammatory thing you can – long-chain omega-3s like DHA and EPA, which you cannot get from a vegetable source. You cannot get those. If you're in perfect health and don't have stress, you can convert things like flax oil to those long-chain, but – you cannot get them from a vegetarian diet. So those are radically problematic. Again, there are people that are getting 50 to 1 omega-6s to omega-1s. So if you go out and eat a hamburger, I don't want to name any particular organization, but any fast food restaurant, you are going to be just dousing yourself in omega-6 fatty acids and worse, and massive amounts of arachidonic acid, which is one of the most inflammatory things you can put in your system. If you go to a true free-range, grass-fed beef or butcher and get a hamburger, that can have almost the same omega-3 to omega-6 ratios as salmon. Okay, so all animals that are grass-fed, all game animals have always traditionally had very high levels of omega-3 fatty acids. I remember my dad, I thought he was nuts. I remember he'd say, God, I can't believe you guys eat these steaks. You know, this stuff is horrible. And when I was a kid, the fat was all yellow. It's like, what are you talking about? Well, I didn't know that fat is supposed to be yellow. If it has a high omega-3 fatty acid content, it's yellow fat. What we get is this white fat, which is death. Right? So omega-3 fatty acids in high quantities. Medscape, again, they're always about 10 to 20 years behind on nutrition. I'm serious with that. Actually, in this, they're 40 years behind. The first good studies on omega-3 fatty acid intake were done 40 years ago. There have been six huge major epidemiological studies done, and Medscape finally got around to concluding that fish oil is better than any drug made for the prevention of cardiovascular disease. Okay? Arrhythmias, congestive heart failure, and the whole gamut. Now, that still has not changed what I see in terms of recommendations coming in from medical doctors, but that's what it says in the literature. So those are my two absolutes. Otherwise, it's all seasonal. Okay? So again, during the summer, I want people to get as much liquid, as much cooling food as possible. If you drink alcohol, the time not to drink it is in the summer, especially for lunch. Three martini lunch in the summer will kill you, because the time the heart is most active is from 11 to 1, right at lunchtime. And so if you put that together with the alcohol during the summer, the hot summer, it's a recipe for disaster. Okay. Well, sure. Green vegetables, right? I mean, everybody pretty much, I think, knows that. Fruit, high-quality fruit. I don't like fruit in excess. And high-quality fish, which is almost impossible to find. Okay? You know, it's unfortunately a nightmare. But let me tell you the foods to avoid. That's easier. Basically, any food that you grow yourself is probably okay. Any food that you get from a farmer's market where you trust the people is probably okay. You always need to wash it for pesticide residue anyway. The things to avoid. The number one allergen in the world is beta-casein A1. Over 80% of the population is allergic to that. It's the primary protein in milk. It is deadly. Children that drink that type of milk have seven times the rate of juvenile onset diabetes. There's a much higher level of adult onset diabetes in people that drink that milk. And that particular subset is what we drink in the United States. Holstein cows, the black and white cows, give lots of milk, but it's mostly that protein type. If you go to France, that type of cow is actually illegal to use for milking. They use only Jerseys and Guernseys, which give a different beta casein, which is much less likely to cause diabetes and massive inflammation. Number two, you can't eat wheat. You just got to get over it. The gamut of people that I deal with, from anywhere from celiac disease to gross wheat intolerance, is huge. And I test them. I do blood tests. I do IgG, IgA, the whole gamut of testing. And the problem is, again, 4,000 years ago, wheat was fine, right? Spelt, Kamet, things like that. But every generation, they keep hybridizing it so it will grow in worse soil and produce stickier, more glutinous wheat, because it makes really good bread, and nobody cares about the nutritional content. So every time they do that, and every time the gluten content goes up, it becomes more deadly. Gluten is a glycoprotein. So what that means is a protein with sugar molecules, and those sugar molecules make it stick. How many you've taken, you can take if you're making bread, you can stick it on the wall, right? That's because it has a lot of glycoproteins. The thing, though, is when you put that in your gut, it does the same thing. Those glycoproteins go undigested through until they get to the small intestine, and then they stick. And if you have any impairment in gut function, you will get those proteins in contact with your immune system, which will cause massive inflammation. So that's number two. Corn, you shouldn't get near corn. High fructose corn syrup is the primary scourge of our culture. It will cost billions and billions of dollars in damage, and even corn is a problem because, again, of the hybridization. Soy that has not been properly, there are about 1,000 different types of soybeans, 900 and something different types of soybeans. The nutritional content varies massively, and it depends on when you pick them and how you pick them. And you've got to understand that what gets picked is the worst because it's the fastest growing and it has the highest levels of phytic acid. And phytic acid in soybeans blocks the uptake of minerals in your system. In China, they used to call soybeans the king of grains. They called it the king of grains because it was the best fertilizer, because it had so much nitrate content, it would fertilize anything. But they didn't eat soy in China. That is a total fallacy, until they learned to ferment it, because when you ferment it, it lowers the phytic acid content so that it can be properly assimilated. But until then, you will starve to death if you eat soy long enough because it will block mineral uptake. Okay, so those are some foods to avoid like the plague, in my opinion. We're currently doing a detox in our office, and there are 6 foods we're eliminating. Every single person that we've talked to, there are about 40 people doing this, after 4 days, they're all shocked at how good they feel once they get those inflammatory foods out of the system. Because, again, those soy is also very high in lectins. Those are those glycoproteins that stick to your intestines, and so it, too, is very likely to become an allergen for you. Well, the one. Wow. Thanks. Dairy, wheat, corn, soy. The one I didn't mention is eggs. And eggs are eliminated here. I'm a big lover of eggs, but here we're eliminating because it is a very high on the allergen list. I believe primarily because our injections that we got, our vaccines, were grown in eggs. So you're injecting those proteins from the eggs directly into your system. I don't have validation for that, but that's what I think. And so eggs tend to be very problematic. The other thing we've removed is tomatoes. Not because of the allergens, but because tomatoes have the highest histamine content, and if you have any other allergies, the tomatoes will trigger it. So that's just for 3 weeks, people are not doing it, and everybody that I talk to feels dramatically better after a few days. Yeah?
How about lactose-free milk?
Well, lactose is a milk sugar, and the problem is manifold. So people are not, that's not an allergy. Or even a hypersensitivity. It's the inability to break down that milk sugar. Milk was a fairly recent addition to the human diet, probably 10,000 years ago, and so only the brush border cells are really designed. Anyway, you can't digest. It's hard for everybody to digest. But the bottom line is, if you drink raw milk has the enzymes in it, including lactase, that break down the lactose. But once you pasteurize it, all of those enzymes are destroyed. So that's why you can't break down the lactose. But on top of that, when you pasteurize milk, it chemically changes it so the casein, that really nasty stuff I was talking about, gets bound to the calcium. And that's why cow milk is such a horrible supplier of calcium. We drink more dairy than any country in the world, and we have the highest rate of osteoporosis. You know, we got to get a clue sometime, right? It's not working. And that's largely because of the pasteurization process. And so what happens is they get entangled. They don't break down. We can't get the calcium out, and the casein stays in our system longer, continuing to inflame us. So raw milk is generally okay if it's just a lactose intolerance.
Yeah.
Okay.
How about yogurt?
Yogurt is much better. In yogurt, the bacteria that break it down, in cheese, what happens, so you get curds and whey. Right? The curds are primarily the casein, and the whey is primarily the lactobumin, which people have less of a likelihood of being allergic to. So cheese is purified casein. It's just, yeah, I love cheese. I understand. Believe me, this is painful for me to even talk about. No, but with yogurt, what's left is the whey, and it's much less likely to be allergenic. Plus, the action of the bacteria on it will restore a lot of the enzyme activity. And the probiotics, of course, are good for you. So kefir, yogurt are probably okay, although I really prefer my patients do goat milk because the casein is beta-casein A2, which is not as inflammatory. So goat milk, yogurt, I'm okay with. Yes, I think she... Huh? Well, colostrum is the pre-milk. All mammals, when they start lactating, before the actual milk comes, there's a substance called colostrum. And colostrum essentially is the key to turn on the immune system in this infant who has no bacteria in their gut. And they've got to get it there quickly, and they've got to get protection because it's a vicious world out there. And so colostrum is what does that. In children particularly who have not been breastfed, it's a huge problem in terms of immunity. They always, almost always, will develop allergies. So colostrum does not have the milk proteins in it if it's good quality colostrum. Did you say lecithin? Yes. Yeah, no, I don't have a problem with that because the way it's processed, most of the soy protein is gone. Although I'd rather have you get your lecithin from eggs.
A very quick...
Colostrum is the pre-milk. It's what comes. There's a watery-looking substance that when a baby starts nursing, there's a watery, clear substance that comes out, sometimes kind of milky-looking, that is before the actual milk comes. And that colostrum is what starts the immune system functioning. And it's actually very popular to use to really help immune function.
We have three very quick questions. One is soy milk. Is that acceptable?
No, okay. Not to me.
Okay. Let
me back up. Again, everything's individualized. There are a few menopausal women that have the right body type that I think are okay doing soy milk. Men should not get near soy milk. It's estrogenic. I don't know how many of you men want to have more estrogen. With children that do soy formulas, particularly the older soy formulas, we're getting the equivalent of 2 to 3 birth controls per day. And you're having a lot of little boys developing breasts, and women, little baby girls having a lot of problems. Soy-fed children have 9 to 25 times the mortality rate of breastfed children.
Okay. Yeah. Another question. We have a very dear friend who lives in Beijing who has given as her life purpose keeping us healthy.
Uh-huh.
And she always,
congratulations.
When she comes to visit, she brings things. Well, she brought something called fungus this last time. She said, that's very good for you. Do you have a comment on that?
There are many types of fungus, and I could guess perhaps at which one she's talking about. Bottom line is fungus is generally good.
Okay.
I'm generally supportive. But there are 3 or 4 different fungi cultures that are kind of floating around here that are very good.
This comes from a tree.
Yeah. It's probably... Yeah, the number one thing that I use in my practice for lung health and for really regenerating even some adrenal function are mushroom products. And there are 2 of them that are tree fungi out of the 6 that I use, and they're incredibly, incredibly powerful to build the immune system. In fact, if you go to China, you will see huge balls of it, and it sells for tens of thousands of dollars. Very expensive stuff. It's a fungus. It's, you know, grows out in the... Oh, there's many, many different kinds. There's Coriolis. There's Cordyceps, which is probably the best general immune system. I like Coriolis for the lungs. There's Reishi and Lingzhi. They're all great. You know, by the way, I do a radio show every Thursday from 8 to 9 a.m., and the whole show is an hour of this. So if you want to, if we don't get to your question today, call in next Thursday, and we'll handle it for as long as we need to.
Yes.
KEST 1450. And we have flyers out front. Yes?
Quick question. Is sprouted wheat okay?
Sprouted wheat is generally okay for most people because it hasn't developed the gluten. The gluten is really in the grain part of it and not in the sprouting plant.
Hi, just a quick question. Allergy season is up right now.
It sure is.
I wanted to know if you had any general recommendations in herbs or... anything that could be taken to help people with allergies?
Yeah, thousands. The top 2 simple things are quercetin. Quercetin's a mast cell binder. It's actually getting really popular now, unfortunately, because it'll get more expensive because Lance Armstrong's is touting it as the biggest energy builder, which is not what it's been traditionally used for. If you do an antihistamine, the antihistamine doesn't stop the histamine. Histamine is what causes all these reactions in the body, all the allergies. And antihistamines stop it from affecting the cell, the receptor cells. But the histamine's still there, and it's not healthy. It creates, in Chinese medicine, creates a lot of heat. Quercetin acts at the front of the reaction, and it thickens the mast cells, the cells that release histamine, and it's a binder. So it keeps them from exploding when they shouldn't. So often with people with mild allergies, quercetin's enough to bring it down under control. Other than that, I have probably 1,000 different herbal formulas that I might use, but I would definitely make sure vitamin D levels are okay. Again, vitamin D isn't a vitamin, it's a hormone, and it is the single, by far, most important factor for immune function. So someone asked about my major foods. You either need to get 15 minutes of sun every day during the summer, but that's not enough here. The number one deficiency in this country is vitamin D overwhelmingly. Women that take vitamin D, menopausal women that take appropriate amounts of vitamin D, according to the National Institutes of Health study, have 77% fewer overall cancers. Men that take accurate amounts of vitamin D, and I recommend you get tested to determine how much you need, men of my age have 75% fewer cardiovascular events if they have proper vitamin D levels. New study came out last week. In children given vitamin D, it reduced asthma symptoms or asthma outbreaks by 6 times. The kids on vitamin D had 1 outbreak for every 6 that the kids not on vitamin D had. So that's critical for allergies. It really is vital for the lungs. Yes. Woman, back here.
I want to give a testimonial because I'm one of Dr. Nieder's patients. And I hadn't been in a while, and I was in yesterday afternoon. And I should have an 8-hour back operation, as you know. And so I went in yesterday, and he said, well, I'm going to give you some energy. I usually walk out of there like, where's my car? Just get home. It's euphoric. And yesterday I walked out going, yes. And he put these all on me yesterday. And it's a very peaceful, wonderful place. And you left the room and came back in and said, oh, I'm going to pop one right here to get rid of that line, to help get rid of that line and to calm me down. I can't remember something about my brain or whatever it was. And I walked out. The wrinkle was gone. And I felt nice and comfortable. And then you got me back on the herbs. Because, you know, I thought I went to you, I let it go for a month or two because I said, well, I'm okay. I don't have to go to you anymore. And all of a sudden, sleepy, sleepy tiger, I'm getting worse and worse. And I called yesterday, and I'm not kidding, in 24 hours, wrinkles gone, feel better, back on the herbs.
Well, thank you. And congratulations.
And you really are worth it. Can't we hear you if we sleep in? Isn't there another time to find?
Yeah. Now, there are varieties. Again, we have.
You can find you on the web or something.
Very little time. Yes, yeah. Yes, you can. Actually, the radio show is also on, it's streaming live now. Yeah. And that's all on the brochure out there.
Let me tell you something positive here. I'm suffering of severe rheumatoid arthritis. Okay. I stopped eating gluten, and now I am totally symptom-free.
Hallelujah. Congratulations.
Nor do I eat any milk products.
Yes. Okay. The first thing that we do with any rheumatoid arthritis patient is get them off of wheat. Everybody feels better, and I've had patients who were just incapacitated. Just getting them off wheat made a huge difference.
I never eat any bread or bread products.
Yes.
Any kind of DNA testing?
I don't personally do DNA testing. I get reports from other docs that do DNA testing. So I don't do it. I think there's a lot to be... I'll tell you why I don't. I had early in my career, or early when they started doing a lot of DNA testing, I had a couple patients in that were totally freaked out because they had DNA testing that showed a potential problem. And I felt that the stress that it created in them was more damaging than the problem from the DNA. So I don't do it because it isn't clinically relevant to me generally, right? So I don't do it. But I think, you know, it's fine.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. Let me take her. She's got the
Hi, John. I have a question about juicing.
Uh-huh.
So I bought a juicer a couple days ago. While I eat a lot of vegetables still, I thought, with juicing, I get even more nutrition and bring in more of the nutrients of the vegetables that I really don't eat, like chard and kale and that sort of thing.
Right. And you've got a good juicer, right?
I got a good juicer.
The key with the juicers is if you get a high-speed juicer, you know, a lot of them that are advertised, it oxygenates the and so you lose the antioxidant capacity of the vegetables, which is a lot of what you're trying to get. I had talked to Sally, and she got one that's a very slow speed, and it grinds. And those are actually much healthier. They're a little more expensive, but they're much healthier. Now, the issue of juicing comes up a lot. We do a lot of fertility work, particularly Tracy. And with most of the women that come in, we tell them, do not eat raw vegetables. And they're kind of mystified, like, why not? In Chinese medicine, they're very cooling. We want to get the uterus as warm as possible, and if the stomach's cold, it actually literally, physically draws heat, blood supply from the uterus. So we want things as warm as possible. It's ideally, eating raw vegetables, to me, is the best. However, many people don't have the digestive enzyme capacity to break down the cell walls, the cellulose, to get the nutrients out. So they're not getting any food value. So I prefer then for a lot of those people to steam or lightly cook their vegetables. You do lose some vitamin content, but I think the trade-off is that you can actually digest it. Now, juicing is interesting because it's manually or mechanically breaking down those cell walls. So to me, that's almost an ideal situation for many people. All right. Now, I like people to get the fiber too, but in terms of nutrients, for some people, that's the only way they can get them out in enough quantity.
A question here.
Yes.
You mentioned the importance of vitamin D. What's the difference between vitamin D3 and vitamin D?
Vitamin D is a secosteroid that turns into a prohormone. But the point is, yeah, right.
Okay.
And we could talk about, get into talks with medical doctors a lot about vitamin D biochemistry.
I was told that taking large doses of vitamin D3 would be very helpful.
Generally, it is. There are some doctors, Dr. Cannell of the Vitamin D Council, several other doctors, who like to get people up into a very high range. Cannell's recommendation is if you feel that you're coming down with the flu or a cold, is to do 1,000 units per pound of body weight. So if you weighed 120 pounds, his recommendation is 120,000 units. He's the guru. Right. Now, what I do know is that the ranges that are published for vitamin D are completely inaccurate. Someone just pulled them out of somewhere. The optimal range, and I base this on what's physiologically normal in healthy people, right? Lifeguards, indigenous people out in the sun, their vitamin D levels will top out at 55 to 57 units, nanograms per deciliter, but 55 to 57 units. So anything over that isn't biologically normal, right? However, anything under 32 is deadly. At least 16 different cancers that have been identified, MS, Parkinson's, and several other neurological conditions are at much higher levels under 32. But if you look at most labs, it'll say normal is 30 to 100. So throw that out, and you should get 55 to 60 units. D3 is the only D that you should use. D2 actually isn't even vitamin D, really. It's a irradiated fungus. It has less than one-tenth the power capacity of vitamin D3. Vitamin D3 is what you want.
I begin every morning with an ice-cold drink.
I'm going to go with bad.
Okay.
not that you're bad, but but it's diagnostic. One of the things I'll talk to people about their temperature, and the final question is, do you like things hot, cold, or neutral?
Cold.
Yes, and that means that you have a heat problem. You have a stomach heat. And so what we would do is try to normal, rather than get you away from your ice water necessarily, we try to balance the stomach heat so you didn't need it anymore. And believe me, once you get balanced, you won't be able to go near ice water. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yes. I think you have the same philosophy as Dr. Michael Pollan.
I know. I haven't read a lot. You know, I know some of his stuff, but yeah.
Okay. I guess we both are on the same page. My question is that you said earlier about fat with fat. I concur with that. Now, with you and Dr. Pollan had said about, protein, milk, and you had emphasized eggs and meat.
Grass. As a positive or a negative?
This is all positive.
Okay.
However, up to the point, Now, both you and Dr. Pollan had said about within a dairy industry, he had emphasized grass-fed. However, with big business, Monsanto, and right. big farming, it's not grass-fed, it's corn-fed. So my question is, how can one get eggs that are...
I recommend that you make friends with someone. We actually get our eggs from people, usually, that we know, or research them. Again, poor quality eggs are bad for you, and good quality eggs are some of the best foods you can eat, as long as you don't have a gallbladder problem. Very good research done in the 60s by an MD named Brenneman, where he laid out the likelihood of particular allergens causing gallbladder inflammation. Gallbladder surgery is still the number one, I think, surgery in the country at about a million a year. I've never had a patient lose a gallbladder, and I don't ever intend to. 92% of people with gallbladder problems have egg allergies.
Yes, and right? also I concur, like Ashley Monahue would said, cow's milk is good for cows.
Yes, as long as it's not pasteurized. All right. Yeah, she's saying you can go online now, and there are very good sources to find local organic farms. And I like some of the local farmers markets. I think there's some very, very good, very reputable people out there. There's a guy in Berkeley, I love his eggs.
I'm very sorry. The staff here wants us to wrap up. We have time for one more question over there, please.
Okay.
What do you think about lard? Actually, my family is Mexican, and my relatives grew up eating lard.
Yeah.
And we're fine.
I think lard is a far better. It's not ideal, but I think it's far, far better. Now, again, if it's a grass-fed animal and you take the lard, it's going to be better quality than if it's a grain-fed animal, right? Because the fat... Right. has those fats in it. The benefit of lard is it's perfectly, totally saturated. And what that means is there's no place for an oxygen molecule to stick to it and cause rancidity. That's why lard has been used. That's why, sailors used to put it in their hair, because it doesn't get rancid. It's as bad as it's ever going to get. Where if you take a polyunsaturated fat, literally, if you take some of the oils that you see in some of the supermarkets that were touted as being so healthy, and you take a clear glass of that and you set it here, you get over 40,000 oxidative reactions per second. Every one of those is creating a lethal, lethal time bomb in your system. So lard is much better than that.
Than seed oils, you mean? Then it's better than seed oil?
Seed oils. If you do the seeds yourself. The problem is the processing and the storage. If you eat the seeds, they're great for you. Eat salba seeds. It's maybe the best food on the planet, what used to be called chia seeds, but the chia pets, kind of blew that one. So salba seeds, maybe the best food in the world. But if you crush salba seed and keep it around, it becomes deadly. Those polyunsaturated oils become deadly if they're once they're out in the oxygen, out in the air.
Well, thank you, everybody, for all your questions. Thanks to Dr. John Needers, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, for his comments here today. And thanks to the audience and those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.